Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, welcome to this very special pop-up podcast right here, forming a bonus edition of the best of the Virgin Radio Breakfast Show with our pals at Sky. It's a long-form conversation between myself and Russell Brand. He was awesome. I'm going to leave it there.
You'll know our next guest because, quite frankly, who doesn't? He's back on the road with the live show, Russell Brand 33. He's dropping podcasts left, right and centre and taking over with his YouTube channel. 5 million subscribers, can't be wrong. It's the comedy oracle you all know and love. It's Russell Brand!
All right, Russell!
Hello, Chris. That was a wonderful introduction. Thank you so much.
Did we overpromise or did he deliver?
No, that was a wonderful delivery. I think if it had not been in some way, if the introduction hadn't been introduced, I think I would have commented, by Jove, you know, it would have hit me. That was impressive. Thank you.
Talking of impressive, well done. What a serendipitous week to get you on because you're celebrating 5 million subscribers to your YouTube channel.
I'm very happy with that, Chris. It's lovely to do something that I feel connected to, where I feel I can tell the truth as best as I understand it and to know that it's appreciated. Yeah, I'm really grateful.
Well, you're very happy. Listen to how happy he was a couple of days ago.
As you know, this is the greatest, the most reliable news channel in the world. And today we've got some particularly important news. Hello, you 5 million glorious miracles. Damn you. Thank you for joining us. What an operation it's been. What a journey it's been. But it's not just me that I provide the majority of the talent. All these people have worked so hard to build this channel. What an operation. What a group of fantastic young people. But really, where would we be without this? The true star of the show, the Log Store. Thank you all. Thank you for joining us on this journey to truth. Thank you. Let's get to 10 million. Glory be. Glory be. Truth. Stay free.
Right, that's a video. We've posted the video on our Instagram page at virginradio.co.uk. You can see it on YouTube anyway. I mean, your team, I didn't realise you had such a big and youthful team. They look gorgeous.
They're so vibrant.
I know.
And young and connected. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for remarking on them. I'm really very pleased with it, Chris. It's lovely to be able to do something like that, to talk about some quite complex issues and to walk the line.
Yeah.
Virtuously.
Yeah, because you've done it before. I mean, you did it with the trees, but this seems to have landed more fully formed. Obviously, everything's a journey, you know, and it's a learning curve. But 5 million subscribers as of Tuesday. I remember in September and October, it was like 4.5 December. I mean, you know, it's only a question of time before it gets to 10 million. Has it reached a tipping point or several tipping points, or do you think there's one to come, do you think?
I don't know, Chris. I feel like that people often talk about the way that information is conveyed, and I think people have a great appetite for authenticity and integrity. This is a time that's recognised of a great deal of division and confusion, and no one can claim to have direct access or even unique access to truth. But I think people recognise when people are being themselves. So I feel that over the course of the pandemic, with the amount of confusion and concern, with an awareness that there's a lot of political fracture and political disingenuity, with the ongoing power of commerce, I think people are grateful for things that feel very direct and accessible. That would be my best guess at it.
And there's a lightness of touch as well about it. You know, it reminded me of Charlie Chaplin and the Great Dictator. You know, when you can get things over with humour, even really serious things, you know, potentially as serious as things can get, you know, there's always a laugh in there as well, isn't there? Almost always.
I think it's vital that the more serious a subject you're discussing, the more access to levity is required. We're dealing with a lot of hard stuff. It's an unusual time. Have you noticed, like, that even today when people are talking about the wind, it's accessing the pre-existing anxiety and fear of the last couple of years. It's already being mobilised. People are very like, well, should we go out? Wind? I'm not suggesting that it's right to go out or not right to go out. I'm just saying I sense that even phenomenal phenomena that we would have been more accustomed to is now sort of rebooted with a different type of anxiety. Perhaps there's something changing, Chris. Something's changing in the way people see the world or the way that we see ourselves. And I don't think it doesn't have to be negative, although sometimes it seems that it's predetermined that it will be. I think it's possible that it can become quite an optimistic time of change.
Yeah, and you always say that. You don't always say it, but you say it a lot at the end of your videos. You know, this is what I think, but what do you think? You know, and you get so many comments back, don't you? People really sort of engage.
I've been wrong so many times in my life that I've learned to recognise that as the fundamental principle, that I might be wrong about this. Right. I could be wrong. It's possible that I'm wrong. I do not have direct access. I make so many mistakes.
That's so cool. What is the latest on the wind? Because you're the last.
It's windy, Chris. It's pretty windy out there. Don't move. Sit perfectly still. You could hurt yourself or someone else. Put your hands on your legs. Stare straight ahead. It's windy, baby.
It is actually very windy. 2 red warnings in the last 12 hours.
Red warnings.
Yeah.
Oh no.
Yeah. No. It's very, very serious. How do you think the studio? It's not a woodshed, is it? Where you broadcast from? And just describe it for people who haven't seen it.
My YouTube channel comes from my garden. It's in an out the window there is a wood store, and I suppose it's very good for my ego that 50% of the comments are about the wood store. Like, so I'm trying my best to convey truth, to combine spiritual truth with political truth, but a substantial number of people that watch the show go, I like the way you've stacked them logs.
Do you stack them? Because I think the same thing. Are you?
Oh, good.
But
good.
When you,
I could have bought a log in here, Chris.
You should have done. We could have given signed Russell Brand logs. You should
you
do
still
that.
Got it.
You should do that, mate.
Oh, you see these opportunities. You never stop producing.
Only for other people.
Amazing.
I'm just, you know, giving it all away. But they do have a certain calmness to them, those logs. Because it's very Higgy, isn't it? It's very, you know, woodsheddy. It's very Nordic.
It's Nordic, it's domestic, yes. It's ordinary, I suppose. Yeah, I mean, look at this place, the grandeur and magnificence of your studios here.
What we need is...
I would say stack some logs here.
I think you're right.
Some easy paraphernalia from a man who runs a good 30% of the journey. I mean, I'm still dazzled by the fact that you come here. You've discovered your own yogi. You've discovered who you are. That energy that it was evident that you had, that energy that tornadoed, red flag, red warning, through an entire culture, created an entire language, a whole movement. Now you have focused it and you can control it. Yeah. You've discovered what to do with that energy.
Work in progress, you know that.
Yeah,
keeps going. So there's many Russells. So as Russell the actor, your filmography is becoming more and more extensive, which is fantastic. There's stand-up Russell. You're in the middle of a tour. How is the tour post-COVID going?
Pretty good. I think people are really bloody grateful to get out of the house, to tell you the truth, Chris. The shows that I've done have been fantastic. I was at Hammersmith Apollo the other day. I've got loads of shows coming up. I'm going to be in Bristol and Plymouth and Glasgow and Newcastle and Hull. I'm going everywhere.
Countrywide.
Yeah, countrywide, I love it. I'm in, like, at the weekend, I'm in Bradford and Manchester. Them shows are sold out, I think. But, like, there's tickets available. Go to russellbrand.com if you want them. I love it. I'm, like, feel connected to people. When you're directly in the room with people, people know what your intentions are. I talk about what we've endured politically and spiritually. People fill in surveys about the weirdest thing they've done, unusual things people have used instead of masks, skullduggery that's gone on, people's responses to running out of toilet roll. So there's a lot of stuff that's very kind of frivolous and light, but also some stuff that's pretty intense. And it's just lovely to be in a room with people again. There's a powerful sense of congregation and I think a sense that people are waking up to something different. And I know that this is something that's important to you, because I know the conversations that we've been having have focused a lot on personal awakening and how that will and can only positively impact the culture.
Yeah, so it's just briefly, we did this thing in our local church with our amazing vicar, Dave, and you alluded to the fact on the first one, didn't you, that the thought of you and I in the 90s together in a church.
Yeah, I like to imagine, Chris, that a time traveller would arrive in a church in Marlow and see Chris Evans and Russell Brand at the front of the church guiding a meditation and think that their time machine had broken. What's going on? Like, because it's a really sort of beautiful and spiritual and gentle and inclusive and trans-denominational experience, because that Father Dave, he's well up for bringing Christianity or spirituality beyond even Christian principles to everyone, which is a pretty great perspective, I reckon.
Yeah, he's the absolute best. So let's get on to spiritual and God-loving Russell as well, because we're mentioning that. You know about the science of meditation. I don't really know about that. Can you explain how come it works? Because you're really good at that.
Yeah, I reckon this. that your persona is a set of synaptic connections. Your persona is your memories of yourself, your experience of yourself. They say 90% of the thoughts that you thought yesterday, you'll think again today, and you'll think them again tomorrow. In meditation, you access a different aspect of your mind. You fall into a slightly dormant state that is vibrant and awake, either by following breath or following a mantra. You recognize that you are thinking. Like a lot of time when people listen to this who've tried meditation and don't like it, they'll go, I've tried meditation, I sit there and all I do is I sit there thinking. And that's really normal. That's an integral part of the experience. But as you start to watch those thoughts, you have to recognize, who is it that is observing these thoughts? When you notice that your body might be a little bit uncomfy, who is it that is observing the bodily sensations? And it becomes unignorable that there's something else in there with you. You are not just your thoughts and your feelings. There is an abiding awareness. The process of meditation is forming a deeper connection with this abiding awareness. When we do this, we're able to observe more clearly our emotions, the times when we feel infuriated, incensed, anxious, insecure. Meditation increasingly is being prescribed by the medical profession. It's been scientifically recognized that it's good for your blood pressure, it's good for your heart. How is it that thousands of years ago, the yogis and rishis and sufis and saints knew, without any access to CAT scans or MRIs, that it would affect the body, that the mind and the body are one, that the separation between neurological connections, synapses and nerves are imaginary, that within this bag of skin there are possibilities as yet undreamed of, that we can reimagine ourselves, that every single physical thing you see in this world, every man-made, woman-made creation passed through the mind of a person just like you. The very building you're standing in was once a thought in someone's head, then a drawing on a piece of paper, and here it is real. Why then can we not create new dreams together? Cast aside your doubt and fear. Join us. Join me and Chris and Father Dave in the little church by a river. Join whoever it is you join. Go to your mosque, your synagogue, or some secular atheistic space if that's your bag, but know there is hope and possibility. And the people that tell you that change is impossible are invested in things staying the same, because change is inevitable.
Woo-hoo! That's so cool. You mentioned the word atheist there. So there's a great conversation available on Under the Skin. So you can watch it on video, or you can listen to the podcast, download it from wherever you get your podcast, between you and Ricky, about atheism, you know, yes, and faith. And you do somewhere meet in the middle. How does that conversation go? Because it's a win-win or a non-lose-lose exchange.
I spoke to a lot of atheists, like whether it's Brian Cox, the astronomer, or Ricky Gervais, or Tim Minchin, or Neil deGrasse Tyson. And what I always have recourse to is that what we regard as humanitarianism or human rights has to be underwritten by something. Why do human beings have rights? What is it? What is it about us that is special? Why should we be kind to each other? Just what I call Sesame Street morality. Why be kind? Why be kind? You know when you've hurt somebody. You know when you've got some amends to make in this life. So with Ricky Gervais, I suppose what I focused on is Ricky's very passionate, almost religious love of animals. He cares very deeply about animals and loves them. And he loves comedy. And he loves his principles about like what he should be able to say. So once you accept that there are a set of values, then you're saying there is a kind of absolute. And even if you say that different people might believe in different things, and there are as many sets of principles around God or indeed anything as there are humans on the planet, you're starting to recognize at least that we're not nihilists. Atheists is one thing, saying that, you know, I think there definitely isn't a divine source of all reality. But nihilist is something else. There is no meaning in the universe. We're born, we die, nothing matters. If that's true, then why not just make as much money as possible? Why not just fulfill your life with pleasure? And I sometimes think the pervasiveness of those ideas in our culture leads to despair, alienation, isolation, addiction, mental health problems. I'm not saying we should just invent a God because we need one, but I'm saying that beauty is real. Even people that don't believe in God in a traditional or conventional way, and I don't have an opinion on how people should approach divinity, is it important, I believe, to acknowledge the beauty in yourself, the beauty in others, and to have an aspiration in that direction. It's possible that we believe God into being, that our belief in goodness, our belief in kindness, let's make these things more real. Certainly in my own little life, the more that I focus on those ideas and principles, the easier it is to be me.
When you were warming up for this current UK tour, you did a couple of pop-up gigs in a field near us, and you announced them on social media, and they sold out pretty quickly. And you started off with a meditation, didn't you, with the audience? Is that the first time you've done it? How was it? What did you learn from it? Is it now part of the tour?
Actually, Chris, I was thinking on the way here, I was listening to a Muji meditation on YouTube. I know you like the meditations of Muji very much. And I was thinking, I'm going to be talking to Chris about this tour. And I know that me and Chris have connected on the subject of meditation. Do I have to incorporate meditation into the tour so that I will feel more legitimised in discussing the tour with Chris? And then I thought about the various times that I've led meditations and whether or not what it would be like to do that in front of thousands of people and with thousands of people. And I haven't been leading meditations at the tour so far, but I'm thinking, if you think it's a good idea, let's face it, you're never not producing. If you think that after the show I could keep people back for like 20 minutes and do a meditation in the space if people wanted to, instead of doing all the photographs and that, then I'd be up for that. And when I have led meditations in public, once I put aside the idea that, oh, who am I to do this, I don't have the right to do that, which I would feel about anything, whether it's playing football, wearing a pair of trousers, or who am I to have trousers, who am I to own a pair of shoes, I don't deserve anything, once I put aside those kind of thoughts about myself, just think, oh well, I'm doing this meditation because I want people to feel better and I want them to know that they're beautiful and I don't want people to feel they're not good enough, I get through that. And then I think of all the brilliant people that I've meditated with, like Muji or Eckhart Tolle or my teacher Bob Roth, who works for the David Lynch Foundation, and I think about how what they're trying to do is to guide me to that underlying awareness, not just the thoughts, not the feelings, not the feeling of the steering wheel in your hand, although if you stay present with the steering wheel in your hand, or if you stay present with whatever you're sitting on and observe it, it's possible to start to make different types of connection with a moment. When I was doing that meditation, and it was like I think it was 500 people, like I was doing just a like little thing in a field, and like I looked out and everyone was meditating at me, like with their arms in prayer. I opened my eyes. I thought, you're gonna have to watch that mental illness you have, Russell, where you sometimes the old Jesus complex kicks in, because I'm not uncommon with my mental illness of having ideas of grandeur. It's very common. There's mental hospitals all over the world full of people that think they're Jesus, but not many of them open their eyes to see 500 people with their hands together in prayer looking up at them. So I watch myself, Chris. I have to watch the madness. It could come back at any moment.
And you talk about that, don't you, about when you're going on tour? Because of the high that you get from performing live. And you say you have to be careful when you go on tour, especially, for example, after a gig.
Yes, because it's very easy to get overexcited with yourself and your own ego. And our culture has particular prescriptions for dealing with altered states. There's a reason I think people find altered states attractive. Sometimes the drudgery of everyday life, particularly if you're doing a job that you don't like, or you're in a relationship that you don't like, or you would like to be in a relationship you're not, if you're dealing with a lot of unhappiness and a lot of despair, altered states become very appealing. The way that we're granted access to altered states is primarily through like a legal stimulants like alcohol, say, that aren't, in my opinion, and I wouldn't judge anyone else's alcohol use, they're not very good for you. I mean, certainly not if you have an addictive and compulsive nature. Getting access to altered states through the kind of things we're talking about, meditation, breath work, the great work of Wim Hof, this is a way of solving that problem of feeling that life is sometimes flat and punitive without harming yourself. When you go into the realms of showing off and stuff, I think that it's possible, Chris, that you're conjuring up some pretty powerful energy. Some would argue, in fact it's been written about extensively, that the entire profession of show business comes from shamanic tradition. What is it that made Bowie, say, so powerful, or Chaplin, or Billie Holiday? What energy are they calling up, and what do you imagine might be the roots of that in pre-settled cultures, when nomadic people toured around, when witch doctor culture sought to travel between dimensions, conjure up the Hades and hell, reach up to celestial planes? This is something that can sort of happen on stage, particularly the more conscious and aware you become of the idea of making people feel good, make them feel good, wake people up. it's very difficult not to get attached to that. If you see like thousands of people laughing or clapping or like whatever, like it's very important to remember that it is the state that is important, not the individual that's bringing it about. So like for me in the past, obviously there was drinking and drugs and other behaviours that are sort of associated with stimulated states. And when you recognise that that stuff can't go on forever, that it's not healthy in some sort of spiritual sense, then you have to find a more responsible way. Luckily, I've got 2 kids, 11 cats, 2 dogs. And when I get home, there's usually some form of feces that needs clearing up. And that reminds me of what my little place in this world is.
I didn't know you had 11 cats. I knew you had some cats.
Because what it was, Chris, is some cats, biology, and then took over. Right. And the cats, they started to procreate one. Like, they made new versions of themselves through some copulative act.
So are they are they little baby kittens then?
We got 1 new kitten, which we actually, like, that was unnecessary. Like, my wife, Laura, got, even though we another had 10 one. Cats, she got another one. And like, I went, what, another one? But what about the 10 we've got? And then I sort of thought, well, what's one more?
Does it matter?
Just keep them coming.
Who needs to count sheep when you can count cats? So there's no business like shamanic business. There's no business like shamanic business.
There's no business like it, Chris. Oh, like conjuring up the depths and aspiring to the heights.
You mentioned breathing there. Now, we've had a couple of breathing sessions. Do you have a regular morning routine that you can share with people that could inspire them?
Yeah, they should really look into Wim Hof. He's an amazing teacher who, under clinical conditions through his breath work, and he's known as the Iceman. He exposes himself to cold temperatures. He holds a bunch of world records normally for going to cold places in his pants, up Kilimanjaro in his pants, up Mount Everest in his pants, under a sheet of ice for
in
8 minutes.
In your garden?
He came in my garden in his pants, yeah, actually, and taught me some breath work, and we got in the River Thames together. Anyway, this exposure to the cold, it boosts up the old immune system and makes you stronger and more powerful, and dormant systems within yourself are awakened by it. Now, like, he was given Ebola, is that, which is,
yeah,
the one that's not so, so bad?
It was Ebola, yeah.
Right, so he got that under clinical conditions. So I get mixed up between E. coli and Ebola, and one of them's written, no, that's the E. coli.
They're both quite bad.
Well, it's the one that's not so bad that wouldn't destroy civilization. Yeah. I get confused about things like that. Anyway, like he got given some sort of little bacterial infection under clinical observation and was able to heal himself and indeed 10 other people. This is sort of like something that's well documented. So like these practices, the Wim Hof breath technique, I use that, and I use it just to feel awakened and well. There's a woman called Beate Simkin who's a great teacher of breath work. I do some of her stuff. I do transcendental meditation. I do Kundalini yoga. When I was out in the world, Chris, and I had my problems with addiction, I'd try anything. I'm the same now I'm on the spiritual path. I'll try anything. I'll chant, I'll breathe, I'll stand on my head, whatever it takes to access
to not
these...
go back there.
Yeah, I can't go back there again.
Oh, my goodness. So the breath work, yeah, can you share something with the people listening now that they could do in the next few minutes, perhaps?
Yeah, not if you're driving a HGV.
Or... in the wind, especially with this wind.
Oh, with that wind, sit still, put your hands on your lap. Don't move, for God's sake, something could happen. I just saw a mouse. Where? And what I think you could do, if you're sat somewhere where it's safe to do so, you inhale deeply, focusing on your abdomen as you breathe. So you breathe in orally, although Wim Hof, to his internal credit, he don't care if you breathe in through your nose. I reckon he'd let you breathe in through your ears if such a thing were possible. So you're just breathing like this. It should sound like that. And then exhale like this. Continually. Like that, and you do 30 or 40 rounds of that. Full inhalation, bringing the breath deep into the belly, all the way up to the chest, and then even to the head. Fill yourself with breath like your life depends upon it, for surely it does. Fill yourself with breath, then fully expel the breath. So it sounds like this. Do that 30 or 40 times. And on the 40th exhale, you hold out and you time yourself on this. Wim Hof has a great app. You could get that if you wanted to. You'll notice that you'll be able to hold it out for about 1 minute. And then after you've held out for about 1 minute, and eventually maybe you'll do 3 or 4 minutes, you know, although it's not a competition, although I do get into competing with myself, I've still got that aspect to my nature. After you've held your breath out for a little bit, you do a big inhale thusly, and you hold that, and you push your belly out, and you, if you really want to take this to the limits, to push your chin high up into the air, and that in a conjunction with pushing out the abdomen stimulates the vagus nerve, and you'll get some real treats out of that experience, I would say, for free. And then, you know, after holding that inhalation for just 15 seconds, you repeat the process, okay? Wim Hof, who pioneered this technique and certainly is the one that put it together from its yogic underpinnings, will guide you a lot better than I ever could. He is a great teacher. But, like, if you try that stuff, do 3 or 4 rounds, oh, my God, it's magnificent. Then after that, I do a little bit of meditation, sorts you right out. I think it will improve your yoga or your Brazilian jiu-jitsu or your running or just being you, doing your job and living your life.
When did we? Because we beat our chest, didn't we, on one exhale? That was a big
Chris,
deal.
We were crazy that day. We were beating our chest. We were staring into each other's eyes. It seemed like everything was possible.
What did we do that for? Because that really helped as well.
I'll tell you what that was. That's this B.S. Simkin thing. Now, right. This is an exercise where, you know, if like you're sat on your knees and on your bum as if you were in prayer, right? Like you sat down with your knees on the floor with your bum on your heels. Now, you sort of take deep inhales into your belly, like that, and then straight out, in, out. And as you're doing this, you're sort of doing what would be called cat-cow in yoga. You're letting your belly fill up and you're letting your head sort of just lull forwards on the exhales, right? And you're filling your belly up, obviously, on the inhales. On the final inhalation, you stand up on your knees and you push that chin right high up in the air, holding this inhalation deep in your belly. And then bam, bam, on your chest, you beat your fist as if you were trying to make a point in Parliament. I swear we had no parties. I swear we never pounding upon your chest. And then, like, and you exhale on that, and my God, what I experienced is that there is consciousness that is not individual. Like, all of the Russell mechanisms shut down, and some of you would be grateful for that, I'm sure. Like I couldn't remember who I was or where I was or what was going on, but there was still presence, and it made me understand that there is an ever-present narrative telling you, oh, I'm in this room now, oh, I'm on the radio, oh, I'm listening to the radio, but there is something else. There's something else in there. Now, if you're a medically-minded person, you go, oh, you're just hyperventilated, mate. Although this is a Cockney doctor, which goes against all sorts of stereotypes. But I would say the predication to rationalism and materialism that began at the Enlightenment is leading us to a nihilistic space. Because if all there is all that you can count and measure, then it starts to seem like that nature might be disposable and love might be disposable. But when you connect deeply with these things that can never be weighed, you start to understand that there are limitless possibilities as yet unexplored. And if you can individually feel that, then it becomes possible to change a culture, to change a society, to change a system. Whereas if you're only trying to change the system from within its own rules, as Einstein says, you can't change something using the rules that created it. And I think he was just waiting for me to use that on Chris Evans's breakfast show.
And also, there's a critical mass, isn't there? Because it doesn't take the whole world to engage with this. There's another theory about that, isn't there, about the unified field and things like that?
The David Lynch Foundation, who kindly taught me how to meditate and will teach people who can't afford it, because they sort of charge you, because they teach you one-on-one. But if you can't afford it, like people like veterans and like kids in schools and all that kind of stuff, they have really generous programs for teaching people meditation. They believe Maharishi Maharesh, who like was the dude who brought it over with the Beatles and all that stuff. Remember when the Beatles went all crazy and sort of got tuned in? Well, he believes that if it's a small number, like sort of 0.3% of the population regularly meditating, will alter the conscious field. Now, of course, if you look at something like that rationally, it's kind of extraordinary, but that's what they believe, that if a significant number of people meditate, the world will alter. Even though in a more tangible way, it takes only a small number of people to, for example, reject a system and bind together around a particular idea for a considerable impact to be made on a culture. They estimate 300,000. It's a small amount of people are required to change the world, really.
Relatively. And that's why if you have trouble meditating, if you do it in company, it's A, more enjoyable. Not more enjoyable, but it can be more enjoyable. It's more communal. And you can use other people's energy, perhaps when yours, you can't access your own.
Yeah, I think I sort of prefer it. It was pretty beautiful when we were doing that thing in that church. And when I get the opportunity to meditate with other people, it's kind of nice to sit in silence and to enjoy for a moment just the presence.
Yeah, I think sitting with somebody else's silence is almost more powerful in a way, because it's this mutual respect you have for the other person's silence which helps you with your own. That's what I found.
Anyway. Yeah, I think you might be right about that. It's sort of, I said, well, I heard once that there is this type of monkeys that most monkeys don't graze with their hands. I don't know where they are, these monkeys. They graze in the grass. Listen, look, if you're an anthropologist or a zoologist, this anecdote's going to break down pretty fast. But if you don't know much about monkeys, you're in for a lovely 30 or 40 seconds. These monkeys can't groom one another. So their hierarchies and their ways of comfort each other are restricted because they graze with their hands. These monkeys continually chatter. Unlike most monkeys, these monkeys, they chatter away, comforting one another from chatter. And I think, like, in the field of linguistics, there is one theory that since we no longer groom each other or touch each other in the way we would have done deep in our evolutionary past, we chatter continually to provide signals of comfort and safety. A lot of things that are said are a little...
Superfluous,
Chris, is the word. But like, so in silence, you know, like if you look into someone's eyes and don't talk for a little while, you maybe might cry, you know, like, because stuff will come to the surface.
That does happen, the staring therapy as well. I've never done that, but people say it's extraordinary.
Yeah, because you see that people are beautiful and people are just like you, and anybody that you meet ever could tell you something about themselves, their heartbreak, a moment where they felt not good enough, they've lost someone they love. You know that people have been through things that would just destroy you to hear about, and I try to remember that when I'm performing live, that I'm dealing with people that are vulnerable like me, and not to think of the world only in terms of my utility. What can I get? What can I get? I default to that so easily. Sometimes in silence you find this. Sometimes in silence you find something that you cannot find in the culture. The great Terence McKenna, he was a sort of an ethnobotanist and psychedelic pioneer, was famous for saying culture is not your friend, that the culture primarily is used to distract you and direct your thinking towards things that perhaps you'd be better not thinking. In this silence, we can subvert our conditioning and we can access deep latent powers that perhaps we've forgotten, but that are ours and they've always been present. I feel it quite a lot, Chris. I feel it in this silence.
Feel it now.
Should we break for a bit of music?
You're in charge, mate. This is your radio show. You're one of the people that's pioneered this media landscape. You should probably do whatever you want.
Okay, not the band. OK, no, we'll only break for the live music. When Boo Radley's ready, we'll break for Boo Radley.
Oh, cool. So you can actually be in charge of that. It's pretty good that you can do that, because I was under the impression that we were participating in a commercial enterprise and you would be beholden to advertisers and sponsors and you would have to sort of pretty much do what you are told, but that's not the case.
We tend to meet in the middle. For now.
Nice one, man.
Whilst things are going well.
Fantastic.
Right, let's talk about the podcast then, if you don't mind. So you have three on the go now.
Yes.
Right, so we'll talk about the YouTube channel before you go. I got you for another 20 minutes, but the podcast, so you have Under the Skin, which is you talking to amazing people having amazing conversations, and that's been going on for a while. And then you have your meditation podcast, which is called Above the Noise. Under the Skin, Above the Noise. That's beautiful. And then you have the brand new podcast, Football is Nice. Now, how the heck did they come up with Football is Nice as a title? Well, check out the pilot episode and you might hear this.
What I will say, living where I do, you do see a lot of Millwall fans on match day. And it's a nice feeling. You see them like outside pubs and stuff.
Nice.
And you're like, oh, yeah, I remember this.
Match day.
I lived
near Highbury for a while when Highbury was Arsenal's ground.
Yeah.
It was nice.
It's nice. It's a nice feeling.
Fans go by.
And I've never seen any trouble ever. So, you know, it's a kind of like they've got this, stigma, really, haven't they?
They certainly have, mate. I was in Reading the other day and I see all their fans going by.
Yeah.
That was a nice feeling.
It's nice.
It's a nice feeling.
Yeah.
Football is nice.
So I think...
Is that the high note you wanted?
Yeah, that's it. Football is nice. We've got our title.
That is kind of good. That's probably the best one, but I do think it should be me.
When you hit yourself back, does it make you laugh? Because that's really funny.
Thank you.
It's gently very funny, is what it is.
Yeah, that football is nice. Because a lot of the content we do is about like sort of spirituality, which of course can be light, but can sometimes feel heavy because you're dealing with emotions, mental illness, addiction, and some trauma and stuff. And because the other thing, like the Under the Skin, is talking to like academics and intellectuals from all across the political spectrum. And because my YouTube channel talks a lot about the news and you can be in some difficult spaces, we wanted to do something. Gareth, who produces the show and creates a great deal of the content, he's a Hull City fan, and Jenny, she doesn't care at all about football, she produces like all of the podcast content, and me wanted to do something that was like light. So, but even football sometimes, because of the complexities, like football is a subset of culture, the same way that science is a subset of culture. There is nothing that is free from the edicts of our culture. So occasionally even something like football is infiltrated by complex ideas. Of course it is, commercial ideas around identity. But like what we wanted to do is like a football podcast that focused on the aspect of football that is simply nice, that is enjoyable, that people love it and come together and have connections with one another and love their football team, and like that beautiful culture comes from it. I remember when Frank Skinner and David Baddiel started talking about football again, it was around the time that you altered the televisual and radio landscape with your accessibility, easy charm and access to working class cultural reference point that hadn't up until then been mobilised in that way, with a unique spirit of joy and enthusiasm. And enthusiasm in Greek means presence of God, so we must never forget this. So like, so Football Nice is a little bit meta and postmodern, because I sometimes will talk about, why is Manchester United Manchester United? What is it? Why? What is this ongoing soap opera? Is it economically underwritten because, you know, it doesn't matter if they win the title because they're such a powerful commercial enterprise? Or is there something fundamental about their mythology, the Busby Babes and George Best? And then other times we're just talking about like the silliness, how you feel at a football game, how it makes you feel about your masculinity or your femininity or your identity, or like, and then of course Gareth is continually trying to make us talk about actual football, because I always want to talk about the poetics.
Now, he has something in common with Jen, who also slips onto the air from time to time and is fantastic. I mean, we're all worshiping at the altar of Jen, but they're both single, aren't they?
Oh yeah, and Gareth is extremely,
he's unbelievably handsome,
like sickeningly good looking.
And you get this, you know.
And Jen is beautiful as well. I don't know, like, she's beautiful in an ethereal Gaelic way. Are you going to? Everyone's beauty will be listed.
Yeah. This could be a terrible generalisation, but it's not. Because Gareth is a lot more handsome than he sounds.
Ah, how more handsome he is. I mean, sometimes Gareth is so handsome that I look at it, my breath is taken away. Yeah, he like makes all of my YouTube videos and stuff like that. He's from Hull. I mean, he's got a lot to deal with there. He's working with me. He's from Hull. He's like really fighting against the odds. And yeah, he sort of looks kind of like, I don't know, like a, you know, like they're models for a perfume where someone's getting out of the seaside and they're all like got sand on them.
He's gorgeous.
He looks like that a bit, or a watch advert. So he's a heterosexual, as far as I can tell, man. And like, because God knows I've been banging on that door. He's a heterosexual fella, and I think, yeah, I think he would do very well with someone in their late 20s or early 30s, presumably female, in the London area. So have a look at his Instagram page or his Twitter page.
In the pilot for Football Is Nice, he does talk about his own voices, and he does say, you know, he says, the problem with my voice is, and he's on the podcast a lot, and I love his voice. It's great, because it's a beautiful sort of juxtaposition to yours and to Jen's, and the three voices go together really sort of harmoniously. He says, I always sound bored, or what does he say? I sound like I'm bored or uninterested. I can't remember.
I don't know, Chris, but I'm starting to take it as a personal criticism, because the thing he's listening to when he's sounding bored is me. So if he does say that, he certainly had, like, I would say there's some glorious tones in that man's voice, and he's a very sensitive person. We're great. Like, we've worked together for a very long time. Yeah. You know what I mean?
He's very funny.
He's been there during the sort of ongoing madness.
And you say Jen's not into football, but she can do 82 keepy uppies.
Yeah, actually, she's good at football. So what does it matter? Because I can't offer that.
She's
good at football. She's better than either, certainly me, and even Gareth.
Where did Jen come from in your life?
Jen ran a fan website when she was like a kid. Right. And like when I was first on telly on that Big Brother program, like, you know, like people were, hey, look, there's a fan website of you. Let me see that. My God, it's happening. Oh, finally, after everything I've endured my entire life, a fan website. Good, good. Let me show, I'll show you this. Jamie Dawkins. Hello, Jamie Dawkins. He's probably a good guy. He was a school bully back then, but he's turned his life around. People change, man. Forgive him. Jenny ran that website, and like I got in touch with her. And then I sort of kept running into her place. I go, do you want a job? Do you want to come and work for me? And she does work for me, if you can call it work, because she's a sort of a very sort of, I don't know what I would call, she's got her own shamanic energy. She stares off into the distance. She doesn't seem particularly fazed by anything. Sometimes I remind her, you started a fan site for me, so can you show a bit of respect in the workplace?
And we mentioned the team before, and once again, you can see the team on this little 42-second video Russell dropped on or uploaded on Tuesday. How do you get a job with Russell Brand? How does that work?
Oh, well, I suppose like you have to have a skill set around tech and new media, because I suppose what we've started now is a social media company creating a lot of content, 10, 12 videos a week, 3 podcasts a week, and we're on tour. So like what I'm interested in is the fusion of political awakening and spiritual awakening. If you have like skills and have worked in television, we need people with like experience and with awareness when it comes to content creation and editorial stuff. Graphic design. Yeah, but so that if you've got those skills, then you should probably email. Who would you email? Go to hello@russellbrand.com and put job application in the subject.
Are there situations vacant? I didn't realise this. There's a chance of people gaining
Well, there wasn't, Chris, but you brought it up. So I thought, well, this is probably, you know, you've got to be ready, haven't you, for what the universe presents you with.
Cool.
Or Chris Evans. And let's face it, ultimately, Chris Evans and the universe are one and the same when it comes to
Well,
the
we're
crunch,
all one and the same, aren't we?
Ultimately.
That's what we know. At least we choose to believe and enjoy subscribing to. So we are where we are with Russell Brand, you now, and there are all these lovely different Russell Brands, you know, and they're all encompassed under the umbrella that's sitting in between us all today. When was the first time you ever had a microphone in your hand and you stood on stage and said something to some people?
When I was 15, I went to Gray's School. It was called Gray's Comprehensive then. It's called something else now, and they seem to have improved it since I left. I hope that's not a coincidence. I hope it is a coincidence, yeah. Like, when I was 15, we did Bugsy Malone at the school, and the drama teacher, who I've never really given enough credit, Colin Hill, he goes, do you want to be Fat Sam? I was a chubby lad when I was little. I'm sure I've banged on about it before. I was like sort of bulimic and eating a lot and all that kind of stuff. And he said, do you want to be Fat Sam in this play? And I wasn't offended, actually. So he must have phrased it nicely. And when we done that school play, I couldn't believe the feeling of walking onto a stage. I improvised and stuff, and people properly laughed. It was it was euphoric and epiphanic. I felt, this is who I am. This is who I am. And I held on to something in that moment that is still in my hand as I talk to you now. Purpose, meaning. Even though this was happening in a school hall, in a normal school, in suburban Essex, Grays, the name tells you everything. Like, I thought, oh, something has happened now. And from then, it was like, right, I went and signed up with extra agencies, got into, like, little stage schools and things like that. And it made me understand something. It went through, like, it goes through a lot of filters, doesn't it? Because first of all, you think, if you have this ability, like, I know what you come from with Manchester Piccadilly Radio and working with Timmy Mallet and all that kind of stuff, you just had that force in you. Firstly, you think, this force, go to work for me, make me money, make me feel like I'm important. I've not ever felt important. Now get out there and make me feel important. And it does that for you, the little gift. And then after a while, I came to think, I should be doing something more useful with this. And I go back and forth, because I think any of us that have a particular talent, even like to work hard or commit ourselves or to help others, or if it's something more prized by capitalist culture, it's very difficult not to think that the priorities are the priorities that are set by the systems that we live in. Make money from it, become important. It's difficult not to download those ideas. But after a while, when you see those ideas won't ultimately work for you, they don't mean that we're not going to turn up on the radio or do podcasts or go on tour or anything. But for me personally, it just means, remember, you can do stuff that's useful. You can communicate, you can make people laugh. So from doing that little school play, and from being, you know, going to little stage schools and doing stand-up comedy, which only really came about because of the drug addiction stuff and not being able to, you know, getting thrown out of drama schools and having sort of pretty regular mental breakdowns, it was easier for me to work alone. I recognise that the simpler I keep it, the more direct I keep it, direct communication, the easier things are for me. Even though I've done like films, and I've done a film pretty recently, as a matter of fact, the thing that I most enjoy is unencumbered communication, unencumbered connection. And yeah, I wish I'd known that a little bit earlier. I wish that we had a culture that's prioritizes, you know, like we all know, like the reason we love people that work for the NHS and key workers is you think, oh my God, they must care about human beings more than they care about money. But we can't ever really prize it in our culture properly when it comes to, like, should we give them more money? No. Should we not privatize the NHS? No, shut up, we should. Like, we can't ever, like, actualize what we feel. We can't ever actualize it. And I don't think you have to be sort of like a nurse to do it, though. You know that feeling you feel when you meet a nurse. You just think, oh my God, thank you. Thank you for being so kind.
So much better than me.
Oh, you're doing something worthwhile. What do you do? I say stuff. I say stuff until I think I've got people's attention. So the first time I had a microphone in my hand would have been in this grim grey city that we're in now, this grim grey, glorious, beautiful city, that dirty rolling river there, sprawling out in the direction of the place where I was born, because I'm looking towards sort of like Essex down the River Thames right now. I've done that school play and then eventually end up doing stand-up above pubs in places like around Camden, Brighton and Islington and stuff like that. And the stand-up comedy, it's a good route because the system exists already, you know, and I failed for a long time and I was bottled off a lot of stages. I've got still got literal physical scars on my body from bad stand-up comedy gigs, but like it was a long, long, long tutelage, a long apprenticeship, but I think ultimately I did learn a skill set that I can now deploy with a degree of professionalism.
I know you nearly called your football podcast Full Circle, or you joked about the fact it might be that. But in a way, that's what you're describing, because what you're doing with your career now is very similar from an architectural point of view of to stand-up comedy, in as much as you are communicating directly, aren't you? You're just doing it via YouTube and podcasts now.
I think all of our journeys are a little bit that. You come home to yourself. This is like Joseph Campbell, the cultural mythologist and analyst, looked at folk tales and religions from across the world and noticed that there were consistent themes, which he corralled together under the term the hero's journey. Initially, we are born and uninitiated, unawakened people. We go out into the world and hopefully we meet mentors and teachers. We will encounter tragedy and trauma and loss. And the way we respond to this tragedy, trauma and loss is what will ultimately define us. What choices will we make? Well, do we go with Obi-Wan Kenobi and become a Jedi, or do we stay on Tatooine? Do we go to Hogwarts, or do we stay in the suburban home? Do you want to encounter the magic within you that's there already, or are you going to stay here and do as you're told? And like, I feel that the reason these myths abide, of course, and never mind what I think, that's what Carl Jung thinks and that's what Joseph Campbell thinks, is the reason they endure is because they have a deep psychic truth that's applicable to all of us, whether you're growing up in some little village somewhere in Senegal or in Iceland or right here in the UK. You are going to encounter the dragon. You are going to go into the forest. You're going to have to cross the river. If you're going to make it all the way to grandma's house, if you're going to become the elder, if you're going to become wise, you're going to have to overcome the temptations. You're going to have to resist the wolf. You're going to have to not yield. If you want to become a real boy, you've got to get out of the belly of the whale. You can't go off and stay a puppet forever on the strings of a culture that wants you dumb. You have to wake up. So like, yes, in the end, there is nowhere else to go but home, to recognise that you are from this place. You're a normal person from Grays, like, you know, or wherever the hell it is you're from. Your dad's on nights, keep it quiet. In the end, you've got to go back there and connect to people and see if you can be of some use and service. By God, I hope that we can, Chris. I hope some use comes from this.
You,
I hope
I
some
think
value
you are
comes.
Being my friend. So the thing about the hero's journey and about, you know, finding your way back home, is it interesting because now that you're wise enough and have experienced enough to realise that that is what's taking place, the next mistake we tend to make is thinking that we are now there. But of course, in 10 years or 20 years' time, we'll be thinking the same thing because this isn't home, is it?
No, right.
Because home is where you end up eventually.
I suppose you're right. As long as you're able to stay absolutely present in the moment you're living in right now, then there is a sort of a sense of arrival, although there will be change. It's sort of been demonstrated that our understanding of spatial and temporal phenomena are highly influenced by our animalistic experience of them. What we consider to be time and what we consider to be space are highly personal and curated by the limitations of the senses, seeing as we do a small portion of the electromagnetic light range, hearing a small fraction of available noise phenomena. We see reality from within a very limited box of space and time. One thing that we can absolutely say is that we are subjectively present. I am here now. I don't know if you're here now or if you're some wonderful projection, and if you are, I thank the gods that dreamed you. But my own presence here, I am certain of, and this is true of all of us. And if we're present in the moment rather than lost in our thoughts, projecting into fear about, oh my God, is this wind going to get worse? Am I going to regret making light of it? What if a cable falls? You know, if I can stay present, go, yeah, of course, things do happen in the world. There are winds, there are things to be afraid of, but if we can stay present in this moment, not be dominated by our past, not be dominated by our mistakes, not be dominated by damnation, if we can stay present here, whoever we are, then we have at least a chance of becoming who we actually are. I'm in recovery from addiction for drugs and alcohol. They say that recovery, the term recovery, means recover the person you were intended to be. Like, there's an intended path for all of us. We understand that an acorn, unimpeded and well nurtured, will become an oak tree. It has the power of an oak tree in it already. That's just just an all normal fact of nature. And we know that each of us are individuals. We can be identified by our DNA and our fingerprints. Become who you are. Become who you are. The bad things happen to us that don't happen to oak trees. Oak trees don't get told you're not good enough at football, or you're a bit fat, or that's not how you're supposed to look, or how you're supposed to be. They don't have to overcome those conditions, although there are, of course, biochemical and horticultural conditions that oak trees contend with that we will never have to deal with. But oak trees become themselves, and all of us can at least become ourselves. And in that, there's a glorious freedom, because there's a recognition that people are diverse and can identify however they want to, whether it's a very traditional identity or a very progressive and apparently modern form of identity, that we are unique, but we are also the same. That the same way as that all four of us in this room, and sorry if I'm not letting you two talk enough, but Chris is your boss and I'm not in charge of what happens.
I'm
and
not their boss,
oh, really? That's, yeah, there is one ultimate boss. That my point is that even though there is limitless diversity and individualism evident just through the use of the senses, we know that all of us basically have a skeleton. We all basically have a heart and lungs and kidneys, even though some people may have, you know, great skeletons, or skeletons that are a bit damaged, or kidneys that don't work so well because of mistakes already made, that we ultimately have the same organs. Perhaps it is the same with the archetypal psyche. With limitless variation, we have the same kind of psychic organs within us. So a kind of cooperation, a collegiate movement forward between us with respect for our individual natures but and our shared interests as the inhabitants of this tiny rock in limitless space could be achieved, but I don't think it can be achieved externally. I think you have to go within, that the only way out is in.
Yeah, entirely agree. I'm permanently fascinated and spellbound by the fact we're not permanently amazed about the fact an acorn can turn into an oak tree.
Yeah.
I think we should just go around all day going, can't believe the acorn thing. Do you know what I mean?
The acorn thing still. Yeah, we're dazzled by some relationship in the press.
I know, it's crazy, man, isn't it?
Yes, we've lost our sense of awe. And I think a big part of the spiritual life is this sense of awe and wonder, recapturing and recovering wonder. Like, oh my God.
Be amazed.
We've got children. We are each
Be
other.
Amazed.
Well, I remember when I first started working in media, another person who gave me a great break, Andy, at MTV, he said, what is great about Chris Evans is he will apply powerful enthusiasm and passion. He said he saw something on TFI where there was a train set. And he said that Chris Evans' passion about the train set, it was electrifying, so everybody else cared about the train set now. Yeah. Be in awe at the beauty of the world. But then some people go, oh, it's easy for you to say, because I've got to deal with X, Y, Z. And of course, people do have to deal with a whole alphabet of worries.
Yeah,
I'm sorry for the suffering that there is within the world. But all of this stuff we're talking about, it comes about as a result of suffering. It's like, oh, suffering is inevitable. The cause of suffering is desire. We have to start to look at what things we desire, what things we fear. How did we find
ourselves
here?
Again, that's temporal, isn't it? That's our time machine. That's the, you know, if you keep one foot in the past, one foot in the future, you end up peeing on the present.
As they say, Chris, yes, I think that is a very useful image, although an unpleasant one.
Very unpleasant, extraordinarily. Russell, I think we're done. I mean, what else would you like to get out there? I could talk to you all day, obviously.
Well, thank you so much, firstly, for being so accommodating and kind to me, bringing me in here and allowing me to use a very nice bathroom on the way in. And thank you for that lovely announcement that Dave did there. And thank you, both of you as well, for being here so beautifully, flanking the room and being so wonderfully present. I feel very grateful to you for letting me come, because we've been on a bit of a parallel journey, and I look to you and I admire you very much, Chris, for what you've done. And like, of course, I remember our time together at that other radio station we worked at.
Together and apart.
Yes, together and apart. And so I'm very glad that you've trusted me on live radio and brought me on here for this conversation.
Forever. I remember we did a little Q&A at TV Centre when you were doing Big Brother's Little Brother. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
That was fantastic, because, you know, the whole thing about Big Brother is often there are music and culture shows, you know, there were always music and culture shows from the 60s all the way up until TFI Friday. And Big Brother was the noughties culture show, but it was minus music. And it was the first sort of non-music signature show of a decade.
Oh, wow.
Do you know what I mean by that? Because that sort of took over. So you had Ready, Steady, Go in the 60s, and then you had the Old Grey Whistle Test and Top of the Pops, of course. Then you had The Tube, and you had The White Room. And
what
you
was
had
it
the
in
word,
the 90s?
The word.
I don't remember what that would have been.
If you remember, you weren't there. That's the whole thing.
Mm.
But I mean, I know we're going to wrap up now, but from a sort of tentpole tipping point of view, you know, there was Bugsy Malone, and I'm sure Big Brother was there, you know, and then you went and became this big movie star over in Hollywood. How many of those sort of peaks have there been, do you think?
It seems like there's been quite a lot of them, and like, many of them are a little bit giddying and frightening. It's strange to, like, the I reckon, like 4 or 5, getting on the telly was really, really exciting when it first happened.
Big
as
Brother
you
was
know.
Just game changer, wasn't it?
Yeah, I really, really, I couldn't believe it was actually happening. I was on the telly every night and it was live, and I felt so sort of fulfilled, and it felt so sort of easy and fun, and I felt so validated, and it was exciting.
And it fitted you well, that suit, I thought.
Yeah, I was really at ease in that. I really enjoyed it. I couldn't believe I was allowed to just muck around like that. It was pretty terrific. And then, like, because of the show, when I met Gareth, who I do Football Is Nice with, he was producing a show on MTV that I'd done, Leicester Square. Well, all big, the Hollywood stars didn't know that MTV in England no one cares about, right? They didn't know that. So they would
Don't
tell them. No, this is important. This is better. Come on, there's only about 100 people watching. And we had like Tom Cruise on and all these people. And Adam Sandler came on it, and that's how I got into being in films. Because Adam Sandler put me in his film, Bedtime Stories. Then his agent put me in, I met Judd Apatow and done them Sarah Marshall and all them films as a result of that. And that was pretty amazing. And of course, you know, got married to Katy Perry over there. I mean, it just was like an extraordinary, mad fairy tale, really. But for me, what has, and not that those times were most wonderful in their own way, but like this life, though, the life of being married to Laura and having like children, like
cats, all those cats.
Oh, yeah, it's nice, 11. Man. So many cats. I'm probably going to get a couple more cats on the way home, I think. We're quite near Battersea Dog Zone.
Probably catch a couple.
I'll grab a few on the way home, fill that car up with cats. Hang those, the talk of list. There's a wind coming. Get the cats in the car.
Right, we're going to wrap up. Russell, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
It's great. Great to see you again.
Cheers,
really
Chris.
Great to see you. Great to talk to you.
Thank
RussellBrand.com is where you need to go for. You don't need to, but where you can go for everything Russell, including his UK tour. It's ongoing. He's basically playing somewhere near you in the next 3 months. Lots of dates sold out. Some tickets available for some still. RussellBrand.com, and that's where you go to for Football Is Nice and Under the Skin and Above the Noise, and his YouTube channel, which is 5 million subscribers and counting. YouTube.com/RussellBrand.
The best of the Chris Evans Breakfast Show with Sky.
Virgin Radio.
And that was Russell Brand. He's on tour at the moment, depending on which century you're listening to this in, specifically 2022. As winter warms into spring in 2022, he's on tour. You can go and see him. RussellBrand.com. Bye.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.